So our gray hymnal, Singing the Living Tradition, is arranged by subject matter. Now, if there's a plan to the order of the subjects, most of it eludes me. But if you read through the hymnal very carefully, you might notice the subject labor and learning. Labor and learning is represented by just two hymns, kind of like the intersection, and that's the only visible heart of some Vermont villages as you drive through on our major roads. It's what labor and learning is in this hymnal. And that meager selection seems kind of odd to me, given that every religion addresses the role of work in human life. And every religion has stories about what people learn working. Many of Jesus' parables are about work. Work is even more spiritually important to Unitarian Universalism because we focus more on the fundamental nature of human beings than we do on beliefs about supernatural gods. It's no accident we so frequently turn during worship to Marge Piercy's poem, To Be of Use. To me, it's the quintessential Labor Day poem. Labor Day never feels complete to me without it, so I'm going to invite you to turn to number 567 in the readings at the back of your hymnal, To Be of Use. It's in the hymnal as a responsive reading, so I'll read the Roman type and invite you to read the italics. To Be of Use, 567. I want to be with people who submerge in the task. Who stand in the line and haul in their places. The work of the world is common as mud. Botched, it smears the hands, crumbles to dust. Greek amphoras for wine or oil, Hopi vases that held corn, are put in museums, but you know they were made to be used. Now, work isn't the only activity in which we gain essential information about who we are, the nature of the world, and what really matters to each of us. But all of us spend so much time and effort at work and in such diverse circumstances. We often equate it in our speech with what we want to do when we grow up. It seems especially appropriate then this weekend to share some of our personal experiences about what work has taught us. Now, this is going to be an informal sharing, and from talking to many of you, I expect it might well be predominantly lighthearted. A big part of growing up in every sense, including spiritually, is learning that the elders that we had so many grave doubts about when we were teenagers actually knew a lot of things that were valuable to us. We tend to laugh at ourselves in healthy ways when we remember and tell these stories. But before we start, I feel like I must name a couple of elephants in the room this year. I am mindful that those of us sharing here are not only relatively well off, historically speaking, we are really like off the charts well off. Even those of us who have been marginalized in some way by our color, age, gender, sexual preferences, or differing abilities are beneficiaries of living in modern times. Throughout human history, the vast majority of people have had to labor in dangerous and oppressive circumstances with few, if any, legal protections or safety regulations. Their work cut short their lives and limited their freedom in ways that is hard for us to fully grasp. I don't want to make light of all of that as we tell our stories that may seem mild by comparison and the lessons that we learn. This year, we're marking the 400th anniversary, the beginning of a terrible example in America's history, the first importation of African slaves to the English colonies out of which the United States grew. American slavery, though, is a relatively new work catastrophe. What is the Garden of Eden story at the foundation of Western religion? It is our ancestors' warning to us that the experience of hard labor and pain is universal. And then there's the Cain and Abel story that follows Eden in the Hebrew Bible. It starts by naming our spiritual and social need to reverently share the fruits of hard labor. Their need is expressed as a tale of God's demand for respect. But don't be fooled. Behind that plot line is an intuition as important today to atheists as it was thousands of years ago to believers in God. The ancients somehow knew we must live into an awareness that we are surrounded and sustained somehow. We are surrounded and sustained somehow by a great and mysterious web of forces of which we are a part. Cain's murder of Abel in a jealous rage is testimony that our failures in treating our share of the fruits of labor as sacred will inevitably lead to distrust and violence. And what is the Psalm 8 passage I chose for today's first reading? Nothing less than an ancient surrender to mystery about our life's work. The Psalm shows us an earthly king, indeed the most powerful earthly king in the history of the Jewish tradition. An earthly king in his most private moments, suffering doubt and confusion about why he matters. He sees that the unique powers we have been endowed with among all creatures in the world are godlike in some way. Yet David, an adulterer, an exploiter, a self-promoter, a betrayer, knows that even the most exalted human leaders are compromised by personal shortcomings. Is it really our job to rule the world as the first stories of the Bible taught? Acknowledging the vastness of the universe, this king shrinks in awe and humility before the question of who we really are and can be. Now, the Bible is on my mind these days because I've been invited to give the annual Rabbi Reichard Robert Frost lecture at the Ripton Community Church a month from now. But there's no need to look only to ancient wisdom in this subject. The images and terms change over time, but work matters deeply to everyone who sees the world spiritually in any tradition. W.E.B. Du Bois, the great African-American leader of the early 20th century, wrote on his 90th birthday in 1958 to his recently born great-grandson, "The return from your work must be the satisfaction which that work brings you, and the world's need of that work. With this satisfaction and this need, life is heaven, or as near heaven as you can get. Without this, with work which you despise, which bores you, with work which the world does not need, this life is hell." What I'm saying here is that I welcome the hard lessons along with the humorous ones that we might hear this morning. This is a safe space to speak when what you need is compassion or forgiveness. Like Ray Moina, the AIDS nurse, we have all at one time or another embarked on work that, to be honest, we knew almost nothing about. We all found teachers when we were ready, often in unexpected moments or places. It is a joy and a comfort to recall them. Now, I'm going to share three early lessons in my life work to get us started. And the first is, even over a distance of nearly 50 years, the most disturbing to me. During my high school years, I frequently worked on Saturdays in my father's foreign car dealership, cleaning up used vehicles. And in doing so, I got to know all of the mechanics who worked in the service department. Now, nearly all of them were recent immigrants from Croatia. They had fled the Serbian communist rule in Yugoslavia, the Baltic nation into which Croatia had been absorbed. Most were still learning English when they came to my father's business. Eventually, I learned from my father that the oldest among them had probably been fascist fighters or sympathizers during World War II, when Croatia had largely aligned itself with Italy and Germany. But this was never discussed. I knew them only as kind, strong, hardworking guys, always ready to joke around. When I came home from college, though, with an artsy college girlfriend who looked, well, let's just say very non-Croatian, I was advised to dump her. The oldest mechanic, the first one Dad had hired, and the man who then had brought in all the others said, "You need a nice Croatian girl. Once you beat them for a couple of years, they make the best wives in the world." I hoped he was kidding, which would have been horrible enough. But when I looked at him, I couldn't convince myself that he wasn't telling me his truth. I saw before me the kind of man who could fight side by side with Nazis. I learned that shared values about hard, honest work tell a limited story about who we are as people. Fast forward to a less troubling lesson. My first journalism job just after college was with the North Adams Transcript in Massachusetts, a good family-owned newspaper, very much like today's Addison Independent, without the long philosophical pieces by Victor Nuovo. I took photographs along with the stories I wrote, but occasionally the grizzled old staff photographer, Randy Trebold, would be there, his hands yellowed from decades of working with the developing fluids in the Transcript's darkroom, where I was very careful never to interfere in the scene I was attempting to capture in a photograph. Randy would sometimes interrupt conversations or even the actual event, position people where he wanted them, and come out with a photo that looked much more natural, unstaged, and vivid than anything I shot. I learned that visually speaking, professional photographers see the same event differently from news reporters. I learned firsthand that because humans are subjective creatures with multiple senses, reality was going to generally be messier than I had imagined, no matter how careful I was with it. Lastly, I'm going to share this from my first days in 1980 as a New York Times technology reporter. The Business Day editor-in-chief who had hired me, John Lee, sent me the following memo the day my first technology column ran. It turned out that that day was a two-byline day because I also had a breaking news story that landed on my desk while they were editing the technology column about Sony's introduction of a paperless typewriter that stored what you wrote on a newfangled electronic disk for later printing. John wrote, "Barnaby, what a marvelous debut that was this morning. In the technology column, don't be discouraged by the editing of your lead. Some editors thought it was a trifle purple, but I hope you will come back again with another attempt in this style. The column does not have to be unrelenting, and I would welcome bright writing throughout. The Sony piece was flawless. Cheers, John." Now, I don't know what was that purple lead I submitted, what language was in that original story that I submitted. But looking back on the web this week at what actually ran the technology column as edited, I found that the introduction had been made numbingly boring. It went like this. "The electric arc furnace is the one method of steelmaking that has grown steadily in recent years. Because these furnaces are less expensive to build, operate more flexibly, and in most cases are more efficient than traditional open hearth and basic oxygen furnaces, they are dominating the market for both expansion and replacement of existing capacity. As a result, a relatively lively interest has developed in electric arc-related technology." So, before we go to your lessons, I'm just curious, I'm going to ask for some volunteers to think what lesson I might have taken from this experience and John's note. And just to help a little, I don't know for sure, but I'm fairly positive that John saw the original copy and the edited copy, did not tell the editors to change the edited copy, but then wrote me this note saying that they thought it was a trifle purple, but keep trying. So what do you think the lesson might have been there? And Becky, you live with a Times editor, so you may have an idea, but... and we should have a... Anyone want to... Okay, Carl. Please share your names.
I was doing that for you. I was just being helpful.
First part of me, I'm not exactly sure what you're asking. But I can share, what I've discovered in my life. Okay.
This was a lesson. I was curious whether just reading what happened to me, anybody else would understand what the lesson was.
Well, I don't know. I did live with a Times editor, Becky Strum, for many years. So it could be there were many editors who edited your piece, or it could be Times was a place with many egos, and perhaps John was encouraging you while letting the ego of the editor pass too. I don't know.
That is a big part. I will say one of the things I learned was that there's no kind of job training, and I'd spent like a week going around to different sections, that teaches you how tribal and how many unspoken rules there are in a big organization like that, and how John, who was a Southern gentleman, managed so many egos in the business department was a really interesting thing that you could only learn over time. Gene, you had that.
I'm Julia, hi. My guess would be that change and new things are hard and that there's inertia and that it's gonna take some time maybe to get the new ideas worked up into the system, maybe.
I'll go one more and then.
I was my parents were living in New York at that time, and I remember the name for the New York Times was actually the Great Gray New York Times. That was also the name that we had for the New York Times was the Great Gray New York Times.
The Great Gray Lady, yes.
It distinguished itself from such scurrilous newspapers as the New York Post or the Daily News, which were all about lurid details and all kinds of things, and that the New York Times went out of its way to write dry, drab prose because that was how the situation was at the New York Times. That's my impression.
Right. So I'll just pass on one other thing I learned from this, and maybe it will jog some things that you've had in your workplaces. So someone new comes in, and you're trying to figure out who they are. And so I wrote this over-the-top lead trying to, I don't know, be funny or whatever. But probably because I was new, I was pretty careful in the rest of the technology piece. And what happens at the Times is most writers are forced to be very careful in their language. But if you earn a reputation of being a really bright language writer, you are given a lot more leeway. It's never formal, and it varies from desk to desk, but I think this was John's way of saying, in retrospect, all right, keep giving me things. I'm trying to figure out what kind of a writer you are and how much leeway I'm going to give you. And so I offered this last one because I think some of the lessons that we get in our workplace, we get a bit of it right off the bat, and then the more we think about it with further exposure, the more that lesson grows. So it's not always that burning bush that lights up right in front of you right away. So I don't want to make this any of the rest of this about me. Do people have some things to share about lessons they learned in their first jobs that are still with them today?
My name is Helene, and I was a brand new student nurse back in the 70s. And I was assigned to give a bath in the hospital to a lady who was unconscious and unresponsive. And so I went about doing it as I had been told, and it was very methodical. And I'm a hummer, and I'm an unconscious hummer, so I happened to be humming something because she wasn't talking to me. And all of a sudden, she started humming along. And so the lesson that I learned was that people are still there, even if they are not what we call responsive. And I learned that music crosses barriers that we don't realize are there.
Thank you. Ken, you were going to share something.
In the 80s also, I became a certified nursing assistant and worked in a retirement home. This is like in 1980. And there was a very old gentleman, and I used to be assigned to him in the evening. And one night, I brought him dinner on a tray, and he started eating his dessert. And he was like, I thought he was like not really there. His name was John. I said, John, don't forget, you know, you've got to eat your main course first. And he said, what the hell's the matter? So I let him eat his dessert, and he taught me a lesson that it really doesn't matter. He's his own person. He can do whatever he darn pleases.
Speaking of that experience about the humming, a woman of this congregation had some kind of brain difficulty, and she wound up at UVM in a coma. And her husband knew that we had a very close, like, sisterly relationship. And he said, would you please come to the hospital and sing to my wife? And I thought, well, she's, you know, yes, she's not going to hear anything, but I don't mind. So I went to the hospital for about, like, 3 months. And I sat in her room, and I sang to her. And being UVM, I think they have a lot of innovative people there on the staff and stuff. They encouraged me to sing to everybody in the wing, which I did. I was very happy to give. I consider myself a servant, and I sang to everyone. She said when she came out of the coma, she heard everything. It was the most profound feeling that I was singing for someone. She just lay there the whole time. She never twitched. Her eyes didn't blink. And I sang everything that I wanted to sing. And she said, I heard you. Thank you. She's a wonderful, wonderful friend, because she said, you kept singing. Thank you.
Hi, I'll say something now. My name is Francois Clemens. Never at a loss for words. I'm Carl. My first job was in 1968, and it was in a school. I've always worked in schools. And it was a hard time because students were very rebellious, and I worked the head of the school. I worked in a hierarchy. I've always worked in hierarchies, and I've always been in the middle somewhere. And we didn't have much respect for that head of the school. So I really relied on my colleagues for my support. I was single. And I relied on my sense of my obligation to my constituents, the students. And I found that that was a delicate dance that was present throughout my life in schools. Was when I heard your anecdote, I said, well, he's your damn boss. You know, you better please him if you want to put food on the table or find another job. And so I was always trying to do that dance between where my most crucial obligation lay, was it to the people who signed my check. Sometimes had some great bosses, or the people whom I served. So there's no profound conclusion, but that's what I learned in my first job.
My first job was as a painter in a railroad paint gang. And we lived in bunk cars and went from town to town repainting the buildings there that, I forget, the depots, yes. And I learned one thing from that job. You don't want to sleep in a bunk car with a man who's 350 pounds and has sleep apnea.
We laugh, but a lot of what we learn in our first job is what working conditions we can actually function in. Often people learn that they can function in conditions they didn't dream they could function in, but they also learn what they want to get away from, and that has a big impact on our lives.
My second job was at Columbia Pictures in New York
City. This is Margie Young, everybody.
Yes, I'm Margie Levine Young. And I was in charge of PCs, which are brand new computers. Oh, my gosh. Nobody knew what to do with them. And I had a guy working for me. I didn't actually hire him because I had never hired anybody. My boss chose him, issued him to me, this lovely older guy named Gene. And I thought, I'm this 24-year-old woman, this older man. How am I going to be his boss? He's going to hate working for a young woman. It's just going to be hard. Well, as it turned out, he was fabulous. He was great with people. He was in charge of running around and helping people set up their computers and explain to them. After about a year, Gene came to me and he said, I just can't take it anymore. I have to tell you the truth. And he said he had completely lied on his resume. He had had none of the experience that he had claimed to have. The only thing he knew about computers was what he had taught himself with a TRS-80 hooked to his TV, and he fully expected me to fire him, but he couldn't live with the guilt. And I said, "Don't be ridiculous! You're doing a great job. You didn't lie to me. I'm not the one who hired you. So let's just forget the whole thing." But it was I was always such a good kid. My mom was a Girl Scout leader, and the idea that he had just cheated. He had just lied. But that it was, in this case, was okay. It was okay. He was a smart guy, and he loved computers. He taught himself.
Well, when I saw the request, I thought we were talking about our first jobs as teenagers. And it seems that all of mine, I had to do things that were just totally repulsive to me. One was in a five and dime store. I worked for a dollar an hour the summer before college. And it appeared that there were a lot of bugs in the candy. In particular, the candy bars. And I remember sitting in the back room, opening them very carefully and brushing out the bugs and rewrapping them. So that did teach me, it's good I'm working to go to college. Hopefully I have more control over what I do in a job later on in life. And there was one other at a very nice restaurant. I was a waitress, and it was on Malabar Farm, where Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall lived during their honeymoon phase. And there would be a huge sink. I can't imagine. It was like about 2 foot by 2 foot by 2 foot that held the chicken parts for the day that we were cooking. And we had to stand over it. Besides waiting on tables, we stood over this vat, whoever had time, and we'd clean chicken. But the thing is, it sat there all day in just lukewarm water. So I don't remember a lot of people getting sick, but that was another thing that it seemed like in my previous to college jobs I had, you know, hopefully teenagers today don't have that horrible of jobs, but I'm sure they still exist somewhere.
So time for maybe one more before we...
Okay, my name is David Rosenberg from Middlebury, and I'm a visitor here today, and I want to share with you one of my first jobs stories. In the late 1950s, I worked in the summers during my college years in various factories in the ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey. And one of them was Celanese Plastics Company, which makes the very thin plastic food wrap. And my job was to take a strip off each roll they made and then measure it very carefully to see that it was the proper thickness and no bubbles or wrinkles. And then I would write down the grade of this roll. And then, I learned later on, this became a mark of the quality and therefore determined the price they could sell it for. I was very assiduous and careful and wanted to do my job well and measured even twice just to make sure, and then labeled it and sent it off. And a little while after I'd been doing this for a couple of days, the shop steward came around and said, "Kid," and all summer long that was my name, "Kid, you're working too hard. You should take a break. We're doing good work here. You can help. Go easy on us." And I said, "Okay, that's an interesting thing to learn." Then that afternoon, somebody from the front office came down and said, "Kid, we've got to deal with these folks all year round. You're only here for the summer. Let's get along, and then we'll all be happy." And that was his message to me. And I thought about that for a while also. This gets back to your first example. There are rules and regulations in the job description, but there's another level of meaning and unwritten rules and guidelines about what it makes to do something very complicated and make it work well. And it took me a few years, a few different summer jobs to learn that lesson.
Thank you, David. So I hope this just little sampling of our shared experiences will remind us that when we go out into the work world, we're going into a different place than our families, our spiritual communities, and it's a place where our principles will get tested and formed in a very, very different way. And it's a place where not everybody is invested in telling you what's going on. In fact, some people who might feel rivalry with you might be invested in misleading you. So in some ways, it's a more varied and firmer test of what your principles are than in the kinder environments that we try to build here. And I think it's a very important lesson to take about work into the world, out of a space like this where we are trying to build a community dedicated to principle and dedicated to making the world a more loving place. And so, in closing, I just make this pledge to you. In a lot of you churches, Labor Day is treated as kind of a throwaway end of the summer fun day, look back at nature, whatever. Often the regular minister doesn't even bother to show up and just leaves it to lay people to do it. But as long as I'm the minister here, Labor Day will be a service where we really look at the spiritual side of work. I think it's far more important than the time we spent on it. In closing, I'd like everybody to join in singing Spirit of Life. It's number 123 in the hymnal. That's the accurate number. And please stand in body or spirit. We'll sing it twice through.